Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Welcome back. I'm excited to share this episode today because I have been thinking a lot about how to integrate information from previous episodes into one application of all these important concepts, and specifically associating these ideas with the practice of animal-assisted therapy. We ask animals to work with us in session, and the evidence is clear. Animal-assisted therapy is effective. On the whole, patients report feeling better after being around an animal. I don't think we can discount the fact that people who seek animal-assisted therapy typically like animals, and so when they get to be around them, they feel better. This has been true for a while in the field, and I wanted to know more. And in my dissertation research, I studied this and unexpectedly learned something else that I'm still thinking about. And that is the possibility that not only is animal-assisted therapy effective, but it can also be diagnostic. I'll explain a lot more about what I mean by that in this episode. And I feel like the field is getting closer to that idea now overall. It has to do with a combination of things that make therapy effective. And to my mind, we can take the field further if we reinterpret the way we look at this variety of concepts and reassemble them in our practice of animal-assisted therapies. So I want to present this episode by sharing some ways that I'm starting to conceptualize how animal-assisted therapy could go beyond self-report and even beyond symptom reduction measures, because I totally agree with most participants. Being around animals is great, and yet there's a lot more. And in this episode, I'm going to draw attention to some of the things we've already talked about in previous episodes and share how if we combine them, they integrate into where I think the future of animal-assisted therapy is headed. There are many things that make animal-assisted therapy effective, and I am suggesting here something in addition to that, which is I believe we are not yet asking ourselves how what we are seeing and hearing in session is not only beneficial for the participant, but also diagnostic information for us as therapists. Let me remind you of a few things. The first piece, going all the way back to the idea of projections from psychoanalytic theory. The idea is that as children and adults, all throughout the human lifespan, something is happening in us internally. It can be uncomfortable, and as a result, we project it out onto others. Usually a feeling or a thought, some type of experience, both positive and negative ones. Positive, perhaps an aspiration or something we want really badly for ourselves. Negative, perhaps something that we find distasteful about ourselves that we wish, you know, would change. And when these experiences become overwhelming and if left unconscious, they get projected out onto others. Projected out onto other people and sometimes animals. And as therapists, we want to identify these and interpret them because projection can cause problems in relationships. So helping our patients understand and become more aware of them helps them better understand their own internal dynamics, which can lead to a better ability to make relationships. Okay, So that's point one. And for reference, I've talked about projections in episodes 1, 5, 6, 12, 13, and 14. So we find ourselves in a situation where what we think may not be fully representative of our whole experience. And a lot of times that's what brings people into therapy, because they want their feelings and thoughts to align, and they have difficulty when there are differences. And sometimes they show this by saying projections. And point two here is that the other complicating factor is these feelings, thoughts, and experiences can also be displayed by nonverbal behaviors. So we want to be calm, but we're actually anxious about something, or we don't want to be sad, so we try to make ourselves feel happy. There is a way in which we kind of cut off some of those ways that we express ourselves and reflect on our own experiences by narrowing in on what we wish they were. The problem about that is there's a lot of nonverbal communication happening between all humans and all mammals, and probably all living beings. So there's all this nonverbal communication happening. And so even if I am not saying anything, others can sense how I am feeling inside by the ways I display nonverbal communication. This presents the possibility that sometimes psychological suffering could be related to the fact that what I think I'm saying is actually not what's being received. Because the idea of effective communication means that all the channels through which I'm trying to express myself need to be aligned for other people to receive my communication and respond to me in a related way. And when these communication channels are misaligned, in other words, when I think I am talking about how calm I am, but in reality I'm displaying nervous behaviors, then that mismatch of channels can cause a mismatch of communication and problems in relationships. I shared a few episodes about nonverbal communication, specifically the ways that due to our physiology that we share with mammals, these things can get expressed in a universal way, even across species. The episodes about eye contact, for example, shared ways that despite not ever hearing a patient say anything, as therapists, we can start to read these nonverbal cues across the occipital lobe, that upper eye socket area, that communicates messages between mammals, particularly if we feel under threat or if we feel that we are in a non-threatening environment. For reference, these are episodes 7 through 11. As humans, we share very similar physiology to all mammals. So horses, for example, share a lot of the limbic system characteristics that humans have. And as a result, especially as prey animals, they are intently interested in understanding our intentions when we come out to the barn to greet them. You may remember when I mentioned Jacques Panksepp. He's the pioneer of effective neuroscience who talked about the primary emotion systems that he suggested are experienced by all mammals. And one of them is that seeking behavior. For us as humans and our predator nature, we actually make games out of that seeking behavior. You see it as young children love to play hide and seek. Starts very early in childhood, and it is a natural part of growing up. And there's something about being found and sought after that is somewhat encouraging to humans, but not so with horses. This is not something they love. This is a significant difference between species. So even though both mammals have the ability to sense this seeking system, we respond to it and engage with that seeking system much differently. And I feel like these are some areas where we can really help participants in animal-assisted therapies understand the importance of respecting individual preferences and needs. And earlier I suggested that when humans come out to the barn with a real seeking emotional system activation, this can be off-putting to horses. And when we're working in equine-assisted services, we really have to help our participants understand the difference between species here so that the horse's response is not taken personally. So there's ways that without words, these emotions, these experiences are getting transferred between humans and also between horses and humans. So that's the second factor. And both of these situations have something in common. We have different parts of our experiences that come out, whether we're aware of them or not. These thoughts, feelings, experiences, they can come out verbally in the form of unconscious projections, or they can be displayed in the form of nonverbal communication. What I've spoken about in earlier episodes in terms of learning to listen for projections and then intervening when we hear a projection verbally stated by a patient is very important. And I want to take these concepts a step further and share how I feel we can now start to use those skills that we're learning in uncovering the nonverbal communication to make even more detailed diagnostic impressions. But first, let's consider, what are we really doing when we identify a projection? What is the point of trying to figure them out? To me, one of the key points in interpreting projections is to use them to better understand more about our patient's internal motivations and how they relate to others. In the psychoanalytic tradition, it is pretty well documented that patterns of verbal projections demonstrate some history of the relationship experiences that our patient has that they have brought with them to session. And for that matter, they likely bring these patterns into every relationship dynamic they encounter. And how I would like to build on that tradition now is to suggest that there is a corresponding pattern of nonverbal communication in the form of unconscious behaviors like eye contact. And if we can start learning about how to decipher the meaning of them, that is, the meaning behind for our patient of their nonverbal communication patterns, then we can start to illuminate ways our patients are expressing themselves, perhaps unconsciously, now through verbal projections and nonverbal behaviors. And we can draw better conclusions from these two communication channels. And this adds a lot to what we can learn about our patients and thus informs how we can increase the effectiveness of treatment. Let's consider how we can put these things together. Verbal projections in the room usually land somewhere. And if they don't land outside the therapy session, say for example, a patient is bringing up a frustration about someone else in their world, then it sometimes has to do with the frustration with us as their therapist. Maybe the relationship they have with us can't yet withstand a potential rupture, so they state their frustrations with someone else as a proxy for their frustrations with us. Or maybe we represent an authority figure or are somehow related to someone else in their world, figuratively. And when they explained a frustration to that person, for example, in the past, maybe that person blew up and the relationship was threatened. With us now, they are going to approach frustrations with a lot of trepidation. Let's explore an example of a very common way this occurs all week long in therapy sessions all over the world, and that is if the therapist is running late. I'll use myself as a fictional example here. Like most therapists, I try really hard to start and end sessions at predictable times. In my experience, it helps the patient feel a sense of trust toward me if they can start to expect me to start and end on time. And on occasion, something can happen that disrupts the timing. When this disruption happens, say for example, I got caught in unexpected road construction on the way to the office, or the patient sees me run late with the patient in front of their session, then the person will almost certainly start crafting an internal story about why I am late to start their session. If I am lucky, they will verbalize these in the form of projections. The theory is that the projection is signaling an unconscious dynamic. They are sensing their own need of the full amount of time in the therapy session. And rightfully so. It is their time that has been now encroached upon. And for a lot of people, the behavior of needing something has tremendous historical significance. Undoubtedly, there are historical patterns in their life that this experience just touched upon. There are relationship dynamics from the time they were a child all the way through the age they are now. And likely they're going to be seeking to figure out my stance toward them in this moment. Am I going to admonish them for being needy? Am I someone who can handle their needs without burdening them with my own? Am I someone who, when I get overwhelmed, am I going to explode? The complication as a treating therapist is that these moments are hard to discern because I have my own guilt and maybe shame about being late to session. I actually cannot stand being late to session. Perhaps I do have my own relationship dynamics. Of course I do. So when I am late, I feel guilty. And as I say, there's even some shame in it. So I'm starting the session a few minutes late, and now I am bringing all this extra energy into the session that I would not have brought in if I were not running 5 minutes late, let's say for example. And herein lies the scenario I am suggesting is highly illustrative of the unconscious relationship dynamics that get triggered in the room. And as mental health therapists, I am suggesting we must have as our goal to continually improve our skills at identifying and attuning to these moments. What's the most common refrain here? I'm probably going to say something like, I'm sorry I'm late. There was road construction and I'm running behind this morning. The patient might reply with something like, oh, no problem at all. It's no big deal. And then the scheme of a long-standing therapy relationship, let's be honest, 5 minutes is not a significant rupture. But what if the 5 minutes triggers these other pain points? I know I come in with my own guilt and shame if I'm late, even if it's only 5 minutes. I just do. It's me. So probably the patient has their own experience of these 5 minutes as well that could have been triggered by this experience. So we want to see what we can do to illuminate them and support them. Let's tie in some concepts discussed here to see how that could come to light. I shared how eye contact can reveal my own shame about this, right? I'm going to be less prone to making eye contact this morning. My own features of guilt and shame are going to interfere in the space between my patient and myself. And our normal routine of starting therapy sessions is just off all of a sudden. Very likely they are going to go internally to understand why things are different today. Because maybe since they've told me it's no big deal, they're trying to figure out, why am I different today? Again, if we are not thinking about all these dynamics consciously, we can be sure that they are happening unconsciously. So how do I understand more about this statement? It's no big deal. Well, I continue communicating and I make it as consciously discussed between me and the patient as possible. I wonder out loud what it was like for them to wait extra time this morning. Maybe they had something they were excited to share with me and this experience has shifted that excitement. I ensure we have the opportunity to discuss this experience. And this is where the eye contact piece comes in so strongly. Because in my experience, when someone makes eye contact is when they are endorsing something I am asking. So I'm asking different questions like, what was it like for you? You know, what were you thinking? And when I happen on something that might be close to their experience is usually when they will lock eye contact with me, even for a brief moment. So while I'm doing this verbally, I'm also watching their nonverbal signals to see when their eyes meet mine. And I just continue to kind of wonder about their experience. And I also listen for projections. So often, the patient will find a way to share an update later in the session from her week, say for example, that involved her needs not being a priority. Maybe someone else needed more than she did, and thus she sacrificed for the person who was in higher need. Or she may make a statement something like, I saw someone changing her own tire on the highway last week. She was so smart. I should really learn to start helping myself. It would save me a lot of time waiting for a tow truck. It is uncanny, But we all do this. We all make statements that are reflective of the experience we're having. And again, we can either do it consciously or unconsciously. Perhaps my patient really has been thinking about increasing her auto mechanic skills, but on the heels of me being a few minutes late to begin session, I would consider this a positive projection, and in this case, perhaps she is wishing she didn't need help. At this moment, the need for help is becoming overwhelming, not just the 5 minutes, but the overall experience of needing support is brought into focus by what happened this morning, and unconsciously has now entered session as a positive projection. As you may have already realized in listening to this podcast, I am an extreme pattern seeker. And the way I see patterns is in layers. And I try to take in as much information as possible to determine what I'm seeing. So I will continue to listen for how she speaks as much as what she says to determine the relationship dynamics that have just been triggered by this 5 minutes. And if I can bring my awareness to my own unconscious behaviors here, both verbal and nonverbal, and calm them enough so that I can be tracking these things from my patient, then I would gently go back through them to help her share more about her experiences of need and having needs. She may continue to assert that the 5 minutes were in fact no big deal, and at this point, it really isn't about the 5 minutes. The therapy process has a way of bringing these relationships dynamics that need support into session, whether by accident or other ways that we can't expect. And so now we can explore the difficulty of what it is like for her to need something from someone. And that is how this can work in a therapy office. As you can hear, this takes much effort from the therapist. We are in a working relationship with our patients, and so all of our own interpersonal dynamics are in the session as well. So it is really difficult to observe all these factors from our patients and try to make sense of them while delineating them from our own. It is doable to some extent, it just takes a lot of training and experience. And what I would like to suggest here is that if I were working in an equine-assisted therapy session, my horse partner would be able to help me figure this out. Remember when I shared that research from Smith, Proops, Grounds, Wathen, and McComb? That was the research that suggested horses look downward when presenting with a photo of someone who is displaying anger. So the horses were held by their handlers, the people who take care of them. They put two different photos in front of them, and it was statistically significant that when the horses saw the photo of the human who is displaying anger, they looked downward. The thinking is that it was some kind of emotional transfer of the experience of anger that caused the horse to look downward. So in a therapy session, my own guilt and shame could be transferred to both the horse and the participant if I bring it into session with me. And the horse is likely going to display a downward glance. This is what I mean when I'm suggesting animal-assisted therapy can be diagnostic. The horse is going to start doing behaviors that signal the emotional content in the session. And it's easier for us to see because they aren't trained in the same way as humans are to mask these behaviors. They just reflect them as they happen. And for me, this is a huge opportunity for us to learn about how these nonverbal emotional content experiences are getting transferred across beings. Of course, there's lots of things to be worked out, not the least of which is that in this example, it's me as the therapist causing a reaction in the horse. Yet I believe this is where we need to go in animal-assisted therapy, is to understand a lot more about how this works. We need to start learning the similarities between species and how they are displayed and the resulting nonverbal behaviors that associate with them. And now Once we do that, we'll have a lot more data to integrate into our projections and other verbally shared information from our patients. We can improve treatment so significantly if we consider this avenue of partnership with animals. This is just one example of the many ways I think animal-assisted therapy can become diagnostic. And ideally, us as mental health therapists will learn more about how to discern these nonverbal signals ourselves. But a third-party objective partner like a horse can help us learn more quickly how to do it. I believe animals are always giving us information about our nonverbal relationships with them. For that matter, so are humans, but it's so much more difficult to decipher the nonverbal communication between humans because there's all this added complexity of the talking and the verbally made statements. So my hope is that additional research and working in this way with animals can start to illuminate more relationship dynamics that will support therapists in increasing the effectiveness of our treatment. And lastly, I want to thank you for listening today and all through the past year. This episode marks the first anniversary of the Connection Therapy podcast. I've got a lot planned for future episodes, and I look forward to sharing them with you. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.